We are going first to listen to Professor Sison, and then after his presentation, there will be an open discussion. And then after that one, we will also listen to Loie, and then open discussion. Okay? So, Professor?
Dear friends, I prepared a paper. I'm notorious for talking beyond the allotted time. I even counted the number of words. So I would stay within the time limit. My job now is to make some ideological and historical contexting. I think Louis will be more interesting because he will be providing you with recent and current events. And I might sound pedantic, or I might sound pretending to know more than you do about Christianity, but I lined up the three, what I call the three ideologies in the Philippine experience, just to make you know what I think of Christianity. So, dear friends, the subject given to me for discussion today is quite general and large. We need to reduce the scope to something more manageable. I propose that we take up the three ideologies that are historically most influential in the Philippines, or have demonstrably most affected the Filipino people. These are Christianity, bourgeois liberalism, and Marxism. I use the term ideology to mean the study of ideas or a system of ideas. I don't go into, you know, those fancy definitions of false consciousness and simply study of ideas. For the purpose of our study, I shall make some differentiation of the aforesaid ideologies, three ideologies, at the highest level, meaning to say philosophical level, by referring at least to their respective basic worldview. We shall not go deep into philosophical questions, however, like ontology, epistemology, or ethics as such, from any viewpoint. But we shall discuss how each of these three ideologies has taken some material, institutional, or social force in the Philippines, and how significantly it has influenced and affected the Filipino people. We may discuss briefly the ideologies, how the ideologies are irreconcilable at the philosophical or theological level, and likewise how they are open to dialogue and cooperation. We can discuss how these ideologies have materialized in the Philippines and have resulted in friendly or unfriendly relations among their adherents. The ultimate purpose of the study is to prove that dialogue and cooperation among adherents of different ideologies are possible and desirable, especially at the social level, for the common benefit of the people. Some Christians may say that there is a Christian philosophy, or in several respects, but other Christians may say rigorously that Christianity is essentially not an ideology or philosophy, but a set of religious beliefs that the best of philosophy cannot totally explain. For instance, how can human reason explain completely the Trinitarian mystery of three persons in one God? At any rate, I think that all Christians hold the view that Christian theology is the rational study of God, or the nature of God, and related religious questions. Saint Augustine said that it is all right for Christians to avail of philosophy so long as belief in the existence of the Supreme Being is affirmed a priori. Thus he made use of Platonic philosophy, as interpreted by Plotinus, in order to assert the existence of God prior to all creation, and shed light on other fundamental doctrines of the Church. Later, in the Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas made use of Aristotle to deal more elaborately with the relations of the divine and the mundane in his theological work. From the point of view of Marxists, It is idealism of the objective type to believe in any supernatural being existing objectively and independently of and prior to material reality. Christian believers consider material reality as God's creation. At any rate, they stand for the combination of faith and good works as they follow the first great commandment to love God above all and the second great commandment to love thy neighbor as thyself. Christianity came to the Philippines with Spanish colonialism in the 16th century. The early Christian fathers acted in the service of the church and the Spanish crown. They served as the chaplains of the expeditionary forces and as missionaries to Christianize the natives and persuade them to accept Spanish colonial rule. In a manner of speaking, it was true that the sword and cross combined to subjugate the people. The colonialists used divide-and-rule tactics. They recruited native troops from one part of the country to quell the rebellious natives elsewhere. But they also made use of the friars to persuade the natives to submit to the colonial authority. They made use of the catechism, the mass, and the confessional box to great effect. They followed the line of reasoning, or you might say, the theology of colonialism, no? That it was better to colonize and Christianize the natives than to let them be as pagans or as Muslims, no? They were ahead for some time, no? The Muslims. Spanish colonialism could last for so long in the archipelago because of the network of friars in parishes and convents. These provided a widespread base for the development of the central administration in Manila and the galleon trade between Manila and Mexico, sometimes between China and Mexico through Manila. The Spanish religious orders gained authority and wealth. A theocracy veritably came to exist. Within the first century of Spanish colonial rule, I'm going to say something nice about the priors. The Spanish priors successfully pushed the formal abolition of slavery and the encomienda system. But the feudal system of land ownership by the religious orders and native landlords had already expanded. Serfdom took the place of the pre-colonial system of small-scale patriarchal slavery. Corvée labor, however, was required for public works. The religious orders engaged in works of charity. They used these as the reason and the base for playing a major role in the galleon trade. They made money on the cargo space allocated to them. They were called boletas, no? When agricultural production for export and foreign trade flourished in the 19th century after the opening of the Suez Canal, no? The religious orders arbitrarily expanded their landed estates and exacted higher rent from the tenants. Thus the people became outraged. You know the eight rays of the sun in the flag? The five estates were biggest in the provinces, represented by the eight rays, and that's where the revolution burst out strongest. Cavite, for instance, was 85% owned by the priors. The Cavite was the place where the revolution was most intense. Before the middle of the 19th century, most of the Indios and Mestizos that reached the university level studied for the priesthood. But upon the growth of foreign trade, local production, and domestic commerce, more students could reach the university to study not only for the priesthood, but also for such other professions as law and medicine. The increase of secular priests among the Indios and Mestizos eventually led to the secularization movement, led by Fathers Burgos, Gomez, and Zamora. who demanded that the religious orders turn over the parishes to the secular priests. These three priests were garrotted in 1872 after having been convicted of the false accusation of masterminding the Cavite mutiny. Their martyrdom ignited an unprecedented wave of national sentiment against injustice. So you might say that the priests were ahead of Bonifacio in bringing about national consciousness. The moral authority of the colonial authorities, lay and clerical, came into question in the minds of the people after the garroting of Gomburza. In the 1880s, well-to-do families sent their children to study in Europe for several reasons, like getting a better kind of higher education and avoiding the repressiveness of the state and prior-controlled university, and also fraternities of peninsulares who were students or children of peninsulares, no? There were student brawls, no? The students who went to Spain started the propaganda movement for reforms within the colonial framework. Although they were reformists, they served as the conveyor of bourgeois liberal ideas from Europe to the Philippines. By reformists, I mean they would like changes within the system, like making the Philippines a regular province of Spain under the Cadiz Constitution of 1812, which was supposed to be a liberal constitution. In the 1890s, the revolutionary current surged in the Philippines. The armed revolution led by the Katipunan of Andres Bonifacio broke out in 1896. It called for separation from Spain. It was inspired by the bourgeois liberal ideas of the French Revolution. It stood for national independence, republicanism, separation of church and state, public educational system, and the promotion of industry, agriculture, and trade. The Catholic Church hierarchy and the religious orders served Spanish colonialism to the end. But the Filipino secular priests in general were either supportive of or sympathetic to the revolution. Father Gregorio Aglipay joined the Filipino revolutionaries and became the vicar general of the revolution after Bishop Nozaleda sent him as emissary to Aguinaldo. In both phases of the Philippine bourgeois democratic revolution, first against Spanish colonialism and then against American imperialism, Filipino priests actively participated by rallying the people to the revolutionary cause and by being the most effective collectors of resources for the revolutionary government and army. After the Malolos Constitution was promulgated in 1899, Apolinario Mabini had to propose to the cabinet of the suspension of the provision on the separation of church and state for fear that the logistics of the revolutionary movement would be disrupted if the priests should be stopped for collecting things for the revolutionary movement. all the areas north of Manila, the priests were the secular priests were in support of the Philippine Revolutionary Movement, and of course in other places. But the contiguity, no, of the territory where that was very conspicuous. The fact that the priests were all the secular priests were all united. And in a number of places, friars were strung up, no? So the revolutionary government had to issue an order not to hang the Spanish friars. After Spain surrendered Intramuros, the walled city of Manila, to the U.S. in 1898, they made the Treaty of Paris under which the U.S. purchased the Philippines from Spain for $20 million, U.S. dollars, and the Spanish corporations and citizens, including the Spanish religious orders, retain their property rights in the Philippines. This was the big compromise between the outgoing and incoming colonial powers. In the course of the Philippine Revolution, the Filipino secular priests came in control of the parishes and the convents abandoned by the friars. After the revolution, the religious orders would recover from their losses by concentrating on their convents and schools, and by taking missionaries from the U.S. and Ireland to suit the circumstances of the U.S. colonial rule. The Spanish, the Society of Jesus was quickest at taking in a mix of Spanish, American, and Irish priests. The Augustinians and Dominicans were slower in recomposing their religious personnel. I think later on the Belgians and the Dutch priests would come. Am I speaking too fast or too low? The U.S. colonial administration expropriated large tracts of land from the religious orders for redistribution at the price to the tenants. This seems like a statement favorable to the Americans, but in truth, the Americans did more than any president, any puppet president, in taking over the land. I think some 400,000 acres. That has never been done. Marcos appeared to be the biggest reformer, so he had a formula that looked like making the price affordable, but actually they overpriced. No? That's just the trick. The American land type of land reform was also unaffordable in the long run. Hit a peasant family with one bad crop, one bad weather, or a sickness and an illness in the family, then many of the former revolutionaries were the ones who succeeded in purchasing the land. So the Aguinaldos, the three of Tironas, the Rianzares, Bautistas, they became a big landlords eventually. Anyway, that's an aside. I couldn't. The religious orders sent a part of their cash income to the Rome headquarters and used another part to invest in big comprador operations run by the rich Spanish families, Rojas, Ayala, and Soriano. The church sometimes is described medieval and feudal, but I think after the coming of the Americans, the church became more of a big comprador. The linkage the church and the biggest comprador families like the Ayalas, Sorianos, you can see that in the Bank of the Philippine Islands.
Even in
although those in charge of the Archdiocese of Manila are more known, no, to have big shares there. But the Augustinians and the Dominicans are known to deposit large amounts in the Bank of the Philippine Islands. As the U.S. colonial government established the public school system and encouraged Protestant missions to enter the Philippines, the Catholic Church and the religious orders, including new ones from the U.S., developed their own educational system at various levels. They used both the churches and the schools to retain their role as the dominant church in the Philippines. Through the Catholic schools, they combined in the curricula religious instruction with the subjects of bourgeois liberal education and training. There's nothing surprising about that, that the bourgeois education can go with religious education. And if you look, you might be surprised. When the Muslims control Spain, eventually there would be a toleration between the two sides. In the social encyclicals, since Rerum Novarum, the popes present the church as above Marxism and liberalism, or above socialism and capitalism, and as being in favor of some idealized medieval guild system. But in Catholic schools in the Philippines, there is in fact a partiality to capitalism and bourgeois liberal ideas, especially in courses in business, accounting, law, economics, political science, and other social sciences. The church believes that the encyclicals would help the members of the exploiting classes to have a social conscience and to cope with the social discontent and mass movements of the working people. In the second half of the 1930s, the Commonwealth Government President Quezon raised the slogan of social justice and offered cooperation to progressive organizations in order to deal with the social discontent and the threat of fascism. Fascist-minded Spanish Dominican friars openly provoked President Quezon when they had the school band play a Spanish fascist march when he visited this Lateran alma mater. A fascist-minded American Jesuit, Father McCoughlin, also used the Chesterton Guild to make radio broadcasts of anti-Bolshevik propaganda. I said in the same paragraph, I give credit to a part of the church for good policy and for at the same time, at that time when there were so many Spaniards in, especially in the Dominican orders, and sometimes fascist ideas from Spain would come. That's in the 30s. I don't know if you read that, you can read that from the history books. During my years in high school, this is autobiographical.
and probably a century.
During my years in high school at the Ateneo de Manila in the 1950s, the Jesuits there were quite rabid in pushing Cold War propaganda and were proud of the Jesuit-educated Senator Joseph McCarthy, of witch hunt notoriety. They called then Senator Claro Mayorecto a crazy communist. Jesuit-trained anti-communists like Manuel Manahan and Raul Manglapos were the rara boys of the CIA handpicked President Magsaysay. I was deeply pleased when Father Hilario Lim rebelled against the Jesuit order, and together with other priests belonging to other religious orders, like Father Manaligo, no, the Dominican.
SBD.
SBD.
Manaligod was SBD.
And I don't remember the one in the Dominican order. They advocated the Philippinization of the Catholic religious orders. This is some kind of extension of the secularization movement. I helped him to speak in the University of the Philippines, Father Lim, and in other universities. I was very glad to do so because I saw the colleges and universities run by the foreign-controlled religious orders as the hotbeds of the most reactionary ideas, intolerant of patriotic and progressive ideas. The influence of Catholic thinking extended into the supposedly non-sectarian and liberal University of the Philippines when I was a student and then a young teacher. The Catholic militants among the faculty and students tended to overreach. At one time, I denounced the authorities in my department for overloading a course on great ideas with the writings of such Catholic thinkers as Cardinal Newman, G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc, the neo-Thomist Jacques Maritain, and Etienne Gilson, and totally ignoring those of Marx and Engels. Cardinal Santos and other bishops endorsed the martial law proclamation of Marcos in 1972 and called for giving the latter a chance to undertake reforms. But I had high hopes that the pro-imperialist and reactionary big comprador landlord character of the institutional church could be counteracted from within. the Christians for National Liberation was then germinating. I expected that the CNL, or the Christians for National Liberation, could take more courage and strength by availing of the tradition of the revolutionary clergy in the old democratic revolution and the progressive provisions in the social encyclicals of Pope John XXIII and Pope Paul II. You know, these encyclicals took account of the big social changes after World War II.
Paul
VI. The CNL became a major organization in the National Democratic Front of the Philippines in 1973. By 1974, the progressive clergy was ready to openly support the La Tondeña strike and subsequent strikes and to press Cardinal Sin and other bishops to speak up against the human rights violations being perpetrated by the Marcos fascist regime. The patriotic and progressive clergy and church people did splendid work in participating in the struggle to expose, oppose, isolate, weaken, and overthrow the Marcos fascist dictatorship. They demonstrated that their faith in God is in harmony with their determination and passion to serve the people. After all, the teaching of the church requires that faith and good works must go together. I think Louis will be able to give you much information about what I say in general. Coming fully now to the bourgeois liberalism as a major ideological force in the Philippines. What Marxists may describe as the philosophy of subjective idealism, using the perception or cognition of the individual as the starting point, reached the Philippines mainly in the form of the political philosophy of bourgeois liberalism. This was imbibed by the propagandists of the 1880s and adopted definitively by Andres Bonifacio and other revolutionary leaders in the 1890s through their reading of books about the Enlightenment and the French Revolution and liberal constitutions from abroad in order to confront the colonial and feudal situation in the Philippines. This bourgeois liberalism is more in the tradition of French rational philosophy bannered by Descartes. You remember him as responsible for the expression cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am or I exist. It's Cartesian philosophy more than British empiricism that has influenced the type of bourgeois liberalism that reached the Philippines. The Cartesian deduction is that God created the world and left it like a clock to function by itself. Whether it is that of John Locke or David Hume, British empiricism is preoccupied with the question of appearance and reality and the aspect of perception in human consciousness. The Lockean, or type of empiricism associated with Locke, presumes a material substratum, while that of the Hume type presumes reality as nothing but the complex of sense data. I don't know if you're aware of Lenin's critique of materialism and imperial criticism. He demonstrated that the empiricism of Bishop Berkeley is like the empiricism of Hume, and it leads to God. While it emphasizes solipsism, actually it rests on so much pityism, no? On faith, no? Anyway, I told you that we are not going to go deep into philosophical concepts. At any rate, bourgeois liberalism, as it has come to the Philippines, upholds the Declaration of the Rights of Man. the principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity, science and democracy, freedom of thought and belief, enlightenment and education. Those are watchwords from the Enlightenment and French Revolution. Our Filipino revolutionary forefathers drew the ideas of bourgeois liberalism from their original sources in continental Europe. So not only from England, not just from England or from America, but straight from the most original source. If we look for earlier conveyors of bourgeois ideology other than the reformist propagandists of the 1880s, we can look at the records of the Freemasons in the 19th century. After the defeat of the Spaniards by the British conquest of Manila, the British could come and go, and they did business very well in the Philippines. And among the British were Freemasons. So they could have been, they were carriers of liberal ideas, and also Latin American conscripts. Mexican, for instance, a Mexican sergeant belonged to the Freemasonry, and he incited to mutiny Spanish troops in Intramuros as early as 1850. Because remember, the Bolivarian Revolution came so early, no? Relative to Asia, where we are the first, no? To make the liberal revolution. In connection with the French Revolution, exponents of bourgeois liberalism divided into two. The Jacobins, or in French, Jacobins, who were determined to end the Ancien Régime by armed revolution, and the Girondists, who wanted to peacefully morph or change into monarchy into a constitutional one. A similar dichotomy occurred in the Philippines, with José Rizal seeking to establish the reformist La Liga de los Compromisarios, and Andrés Bonifacio, the revolutionary Katipunan. Revolutionary ideology may come from abroad because the revolutionary movement developed there ahead and won power earlier. But it is not only a matter of subjective borrowing from abroad. The ideas must first of all be applicable to the general level of social development and motivate the local revolutionary class and the people to wage revolution. In struggling against the colonial and feudal situation, the nascent bourgeoisie adopted bourgeois liberalism as the guiding ideology rather than Marxism, which then was also available. It was fine enough that the Filipino people and revolutionary forces pioneered the bourgeois democratic revolution in colonial Asia. The Philippine Revolution won resoundingly against Spanish colonialism. The revolutionary leaders and government produced political writings and adopted and implemented policies which reflected the Filipino people's conditions, needs, demands, and aspirations for national independence, democracy, social justice, and all-round social progress. But U.S. imperialism intervened and launched a war of aggression against the Philippine Republic. To succeed, it used not only superior military power and tremendous economic resources, but also ideological and political deception. To justify the aggression, it claimed to bring Christianity, again, no? To bring Christianity and democracy to the Filipino people. It proclaimed a policy of benevolent assimilation. It was monopoly capitalism on the rampage, but used the Jeffersonian slogans of liberal democracy to deceive and co-opt the bourgeois leadership of the revolution. Bourgeois liberalism bifurcated in the Philippines. One was the progressive kind, still held on to by those who sought to pursue the revolutionary struggle for national independence. The other was the pro-imperialist kind that became increasingly dominant as the official signboard of the U.S. colonial regime. The false claim to liberalism by the imperialist power had some semblance of truth because it had the leeway to carry out certain changes that appeared to make the Philippines more free and more progressive than under the decrepit colonial and feudal system under Spain. You know, in under Spanish rule, there was the Maura law, which stipulated development of public school system, no? Because, you know, in Spain, there was always a battle between the liberals and the counter-liberals. And so, reform, like having public education system, was available as a matter of thought, no? But there was no time to apply this. But the U.S., it's a modern imperial power. It had resources, and it had the methods, precisely the methods of investing a little to develop something, to be able to extract the big profits. So it's different from colonialism, which started out exchanging blue beads with cinnamon or even gold. The U.S. colonial regime established the public school system. I'm going to talk here nicely about the U.S. Huh? The U.S. colonial regime established a public school system. It expanded the system of transport and communications. It carried out some amount of land reform, which at first was impressive. It allowed the peasants free movement, either to have homesteads in frontier areas or become farm workers in the expanding export-oriented plantations. It opened the mines. The Spaniards could not open the mines in the Cordillera. Its corporations established some manufacturing enterprises, Colgate, Palmolive, and the like came in. No? The U.S. was indeed a modern imperialist power that could make direct investments and impose loans on the Philippines for the purpose of bringing about a semi-feudal economy and drawing super profits from it. Even after its proclamation of the defeat of the Philippine Revolution, the U.S. prohibited the public display of the Philippine flag and suppressed other manifestations of Filipino patriotism. At the same time, because the popular demand for immediate, absolute, and complete independence could not be silenced, the U.S. kept on promising the grant of national independence on the precondition that the Filipino leaders and people submitted themselves to the new colonial power and fulfilled their training in democracy, in quotes. No? American teachers came in large numbers to teach in Philippine in public schools at various levels. The University of the Philippines was proclaimed as a non-sectarian liberal institution of higher learning. In the Philippine Normal School and the regional teacher training schools, John Dewey's books were used as textbooks. His utilitarian brand of pragmatist philosophy was thus propagated. It asserts that only through experimentation and practical results can the truth or meaning of a proposition be proven. The U.S. colonial regime developed a public school system to assure itself of personnel for the expanding bureaucracy and the professions. It also pushed the pensionado system, which involved the sending of Filipino bureaucrats and academics to the U.S. for further education in various professions. Thus, in education, government, politics, professions, and other spheres, Filipinos with a pro-U.S. colonial mentality ultimately outnumbered those who held allegiance either to the previous colonial and clerical authorities or to the Philippine Revolution. By 1946, when it granted nominal independence to the Philippines and turned it into a semi-colony, the U.S. was confident that it had adequately trained puppets to replicate themselves in the political, economic, and cultural fields. A bourgeois liberal constitution had been made since 1935. In the name of a Commonwealth government in preparation for the neo-colonial republic. The economy was securely semi-feudal under U.S. hegemony and run by the big compradors and landlords. Politics and the bureaucracy up to the national level could be turned over to the politicians of the big compradors and landlords. the educational system and mass media spread the ideas, information, and entertainment that jibe with the U.S.-controlled semi-colonial and semi-feudal system. The U.S. uses scholarships and travel grants under U.S. official agencies, Fulbright, Smith-Mundt, U.S. State Department, AID, etc., and U.S. private philanthropic foundations, Ford, Rockefeller, etc., in order to influence and control the thinking of the politicians, mass media, academics, cultural workers, the intelligentsia in general, and the masses. U.S. commercial films and pop music have a strong impact on the minds of the people. The free marketplace of goods and ideas, that's the slogan, no? The free marketplace of goods and ideas is the most repeated liberal slogan used by the defenders of the status quo to describe the system. The glorification of the market is founded on bourgeois liberal philosophy and is sustained by the view of Adam Smith that the social good is attained through the invisible hand of self-interest in the market. Quite a sharp sense of irony. Huh? You serve the social good by being greedy. The semi-colonial political system, controlled by foreign monopoly capitalism, domestic feudalism, and bureaucrat capitalism, is called a liberal democracy. The semi-feudal economic system is variably called free enterprise, market economy, and the like. The U.S. and the Filipino puppets play semantical games to deceive the people. From one puppet regime to another, they describe as land reform what amounts to an offer of commercial sale of land at a prohibitive price for the landless poor. They describe as industrialization the establishment of reassembly and repackaging plants to serve domestic consumption, as in the 1950s, or the export market in current times. They scoff at the proposal of national industrialization on the basis of local resources as backward integration. That's Gerardo Sitar from Harvard University. Backward to industrialize on the basis of your resources, backward integration. And putting up raw material mills and sweatshops for low value added semi-manufacturing for export, that's called forward integration. What is forward? Serving the needs of the imperialists, serving the so-called global market. Since the neoliberal shift of economic policy stress to free market globalization, the puppet regimes have played up the myth of the free market to obscure the need for development through national industrialization and land reform. By the way, coming to these terms, you'd be surprised how Adam Smith continues to live, no? To serve the social good, you be greedy. Economics then, you know, was part of philosophy, natural philosophy. It fell specifically under ethics, no? In the final analysis, the semi-colonial and semi-feudal system is a system of violence. This includes the daily violence of exploitation in factories, farms, and service lines, and the conspicuous brutal force for assaulting, striking workers, and protesting people, and for suppressing the people's revolutionary movement. The imperialists and reactionaries justify such violence in various clever ways. Since the launch of the Cold War, after World War II, they have used the specter of communism as supposedly destructive of freedom in order to justify the anti-communist hysteria and witch hunts and the violent suppression of the patriotic and progressive mass movements. Despite the successful bloody suppression of the people's revolutionary movement in the early 1950s, the U.S. imperialist and reactionaries proceeded to enact the anti-subversion law of 1957 for the purpose of conducting an anti-communist witch hunt. According to its main proponent, Representative Joaquin Rosas, the real main drafters of the law behind the scenes were an American Jesuit priest, Father Weiss, teaching at the Ateneo de Manila, and the political secretary of the U.S. Embassy. I tried to show the saints and the sinners. As earlier pointed out, a socioeconomic, political, and legal compromise or alliance exists between the forces of imperialism and reaction and the institutional church. This partnership provides the widest base for the most effective kind of anti-communist propaganda. In philosophical and theological terms, a close kinship exists between the church and the secular oppressors and exploiters. Of course, the relationship of the ideas and their history need to be examined if we hope for a change of situation or direction for the better. The anti-communist propaganda of the Cold War and the anti-subversion law prepare the climate for the emergence of the Marcos fascist dictatorship and the persistence of the most reactionary policies against the working people in the post-Marcos regimes. Once more, in a big way, the U.S. instigated permanent war on terror, that's Bush, emboldens pro-U.S. bourgeois governments the world over to adopt the open rule of terror, that's something like Makapagal, no? under the pretext of anti-terrorism, and drives the U.S. to unleash preemptive strikes and wars of aggression. Before, during, and after the Cold War, the U.S. imperialists and their puppets have used all forms of anti-communist propaganda, ranging from the crudest military psy war and political rabble-rousing to the most sophisticated intellectual and philosophical anti-communist lines of thinking in universities, seminaries, and the like. And development institutes. I have mentioned some basic positions and variants in bourgeois subjectivist philosophy. It is not necessary to try mentioning all of them here. They are too many. They are churned up daily by the university presses that publish doctoral dissertations. It is in the nature and method of subjectivist philosophy to be one-sided, fragmentary, self-indulgent, narrow-minded, too short-sighted sometimes, and too far-sighted at other times. Certain bourgeois philosophical trends have influenced academics and professionals in the Philippines. They do not spread right away to the mass media and to the masses, but they serve to reinforce the more secular kind of bourgeois subjectivism, such as liberalism. They include logical positivism, that's brought in by Dr. Ricardo Pascual, through the UP Department of Philosophy, and that is influenced in various social science departments in the UP. And that's when you say logical positivism, that's an extension of empiricism. There's nothing valid if that you cannot demonstrate through sense experience, no? Any kind of it's supposed to be opposed to both Christianity and or belief in God and Marxism. Anytime you use a big word, and it's not supposed to be that demonstrable immediately in terms of sense data, then that's metaphysical, no? Anyway, existentialism, mostly literary creative writers, also in the UP. Phenomenology, also in circles. Art for art's sake, well, that's bigger because the foundations, American foundations, would influence writers, especially in the days of the cultural freedom. The individualism in art for art's sake was deliberately promoted as an opposite, no, to so-called totalitarianism, no, in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and in communist movement, no? behaviorism, that's sociology department in the UP, you know. Behavioralism, that's Onofre Corpus. He used to be a follower of logical constitutivism, but at the time he was in the U.S., behavioralism was supposed to be the passion, no? In political science. Difference between behaviorism and behavioralism, let's not bother about it. And then, in the 70s, huh? You can buy two philosophies for every 5 centavos, no? from France. So find all sorts of ideas. Structuralism, deconstruction, post-structuralism, postmodernism. I think you hear those terms still in your philosophy courses. During the, it's in the 70s, and I was in prison then, no? 70s and 80s. So when I came out of prison, I had to do some catching up with those terms. So much philosophizing has been done in the service of the Cold War, and modern revisionism by those who present themselves as Marxist, neo-Marxist, or quasi-Marxist, but who are actually anti-Marxist. We can discuss any of the major or minor bourgeois subjectivist philosophies if you can raise the point or question pertinent to our topic today. None of these subjectivist philosophical trends has more influence and effectiveness in Philippine society than the political philosophy of liberalism. Although, of course, postmodernism, multiculturalism, and similar terms are supposed to deny modernism that starts from the Enlightenment. And postmodernism is a, you must be taking this up in some of your courses. It's a slippery term, no? Sometimes it is made to appear as something like opposing abstraction, no? In the period of so-called ideology, so you're going to put more human face in the postmodern period, because modernism denies the human figure. But there's also that trend which goes as far back as to Enlightenment, or Enlightenment, in order to deny it. Anyway, I now come to the last part. Have I gone beyond the time? As a system of ideas established by Marx and Engels, Marxism has three basic components: the philosophy of dialectical materialism and historical materialism, political economy as a critique of the capitalist system, and social science revolving around the concept of class struggle and class dictatorship of the proletariat. Each component is supposed to have come from the best sources at the time of Marx and Engels. To develop dialectical materialism, Marx and Engels studied German philosophy, particularly the works of Hegel and Feuerbach. Hegelian dialectics was the best of idealist philosophy, as it sought to explicate development, even if through the thought process of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, which is supposed to be which is to be realized in subsequently in history. History is the realization of the thought process, no? The self-development of thought, no? The problem with this concept of the self-development of thought was that it does not originate from material reality, and it ends with the final perfection in the form of the transcendental state. With the help of the materialist ideas of Feuerbach, Marx turned Hegel upside down to establish the philosophy of dialectical and historical materialism, which recognizes matter as the starting point and which explains development through the contradictions within matter as well as contradictions between matter and consciousness. Engels tried to explain the laws of contradiction in terms of the natural sciences. Marx thoroughly applied the law of contradiction, materialist dialectics, in his works. Some people think that Marx simply borrowed Hegel. No, there is idealism in Hegel in the sense that it begins with the thought and ends with some perfection. It ends with the present state as the so. There is a defect in thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Marxism denies the end of history. Even when you breach communism, it continues. Human society will continue to change. No. Of course, the propaganda against communism is that it also wants some final perfection. To Marxists, that there's no such thing. Now, with regard to Feuerbach, you know, there's some kind of religion there, right? The religion of love, no? And but anyway, he's aside from that, he's interested in this sensuousness of human reality, no? That's less religious, no? I've been wondering myself why Marx German materialist philosophy. British empiricism is richer, but anyway, plethora of philosophies, then in Germany it appeared like Germany was the place where philosophy was most developed. Anyway, to develop Marxist political economy, Marx studied British political economy, particularly Adam Smith and David Ricardo, who recognized labor as a source of value. Even if we don't like Adam Smith, you know, at least he recognized the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value is not original with Marx. What is original with him is the penetrating study of the commodity as the basic cell of the capitalist economy and the definition of the theory of surplus value. The surplus value is the unpaid labor from which the industrial capitalist gets his profit and pays interest to the bank and rent to the landowner. To develop the Marxist social science, Marx and Engels studied French social science, particularly the democratic-minded historians and writers, from whom they drew the concept of the class struggle. They developed this further to the level of the concept of the class dictatorship of the proletariat. The concept of class struggle is not original with Marx. What is original with him is his extension of the theory of the class struggle to the dictatorship of the proletariat. Some people get frightened with the word dictatorship because of tyrannies, no? It means nothing but the state, no? The state of the workers, no? As against the state, the dictatorship, class dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. They asserted that the class dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, that means to say the bourgeois state, must first be overthrown in order to establish the class dictatorship of the proletariat, which is the worker state or the socialist state. According to a labor historian, the acclaimed founder of the Philippine trade union movement, Isabelo de los Reyes, came back to the Philippines at the beginning of the 20th century from his imprisonment in Barcelona, bringing with him the works of Marx and the anarcho-syndicalist. But he was not a Marxist, he was more of a anarcho-syndicalist, Isabelo de los Reyes. At that time, Marxism was already the dominant trend in the European trade union movement, but it would take some decades before Marxism came to be adopted by a definite Philippine organization as the ideological guide to action. The Communist Party of the Philippines was first established by Crisanto Evangelista and other working class leaders in 1930. it categorically adopted Marxism as the revolutionary guide to action. So you can state formally that Marxism started to strike roots in the Philippines upon the foundation of the Communist Party of the Philippines in 1930. It was inspired by the Bolshevik Revolution and by the Third International. At the same time, it was well founded on the circumstances of the Filipino people and achievements of the Philippine working class movement. It directed the proletariat and the people to fight for their rights and interests. Like the early Christians persecuted by Imperial Rome, the Filipino communists were persecuted by the colonial regime of U.S. imperialism. A few months after the founding of the CPP, the colonial authorities disrupted a peaceful mass rally of the workers and urban poor. Then they falsely accused the CPP leaders of sedition and had them arrested, imprisoned, and convicted for sedition. They banned the CPP under President Quezon of the Commonwealth Government. They banned the CPP until President Quezon of the Commonwealth Government agreed, for the sake of promoting his call for social justice and supporting the International Popular Front Against Fascism, to release the CPP leaders and allow the CPP to operate legally in 1937. We used to say in the movement that every 10 years, those who advocate and practice working class, Marxist, Leninist, working class ideas would be hit, no? But you know, and then you know there is a comprehensive total suppression. But after the fall of Marcos, it seems like the progressive organizations could stay longer. That's because probably the progressive formations that have arisen have become more battle tested and know how to prevent total suppression. But you can never tell, no? Let's say KMU is how many years old?
25 years.
25
years.
Bayan is 20. But right now there's another wave of attack, reminiscent of the wave of attacks unleashed by Marcos before martial law. Even when it was banned, the CPP did everything it could to develop the mass movement of the workers and peasants. It continued to do so after regaining legality in 1937 and going into a merger in 1938 with the Socialist Party headed by Pedro Abad Santos. When they occupied Manila in 1942, the Japanese fascists arrested and murdered Evangelista and Abad Santos, respectively chairman and general secretary of the merger party of the CPP and SPP. The People's Army, led by the merger party, was patriotic and independent of the other guerrilla forces who had sworn allegiance to the U.S. within the USAFE framework and U.S. Armed forces in the Far East, no? And who were ordered by MacArthur to wait for the return of U.S. military forces. It fought the Japanese occupation fiercely. It carried out land reform. It established democratic organs of political power up to the provincial level in central Luzon. But upon U.S. reconquest of the Philippines, the U.S. puppet troops viciously attacked the revolutionary forces and people, despite the declared policy of the merger party to welcome the return of the Commonwealth government and participate in the new republic to be established. The U.S. imperialists were hell-bent on retaining and expanding economic, political, military, and cultural control over the Philippines under the cover of the nominal grant of independence. The merger party launched what it called an all-out armed struggle to win power in 2 years' time. The U.S. puppet government broke the backbone of the armed revolutionary movement in the first 2 years of the 1950s. In 1957, it enacted the anti-subversion law in order to destroy every trace of Marxist ideology, politics, and organization by penalizing any vestige, substitute, extension, or successor of the CPP. But conditions in the Philippines continued to deteriorate at the expense of the working people and broad masses due to the oppression and exploitation perpetrated by foreign monopoly capitalism, domestic feudalism, and bureaucrat capitalism. The patriotic and progressive mass movement generated by the forces of the workers, peasants, youth, women, professionals, religious, and others became resurgent in the 1960s. In 1968, the Communist Party of the Philippines was re-established under the guidance of Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, and on the basis of opposing modern revisionism, rectifying errors in the history of the merger party, and setting forth the tasks for waging revolution. The re-established CPP is of the view that it has benefited from the three basic components of Marxism and from the contributions of Lenin, Stalin, and Mao to develop them. It has learned from the lessons of carrying out socialist revolution and socialist construction under Lenin, Stalin, and Mao, as well as from the negative lessons of revisionist betrayal. It considers as matters of the utmost importance Mao's penetrating analysis of the law of contradiction, epistemology and social practice, and his theory of continuing revolution under proletarian class dictatorship to consolidate socialism, combat revisionism, and prevent the restoration of capitalism. I miss something. Lenin made, aside from Mao, ahead of Mao, Lenin made a big contribution to Marxist philosophy by studying empiricism, especially empiricism which takes on the prestige of science, no? Lenin wrote the book Materialism and Imperial Criticism. Imperial Criticism is like logical positivism. It's very attractive because, reality is proven strictly through sense experience and through mathematical and expressed in mathematical terms. No? But Lenin managed to defend materialist dialectics against this challenge new expression, no? Of an old term called empiricism. In terms of the class analysis of Philippine history and current circumstances, the re-established CPP considers as an advance on its predecessor, CPP, and the merger party of the CPP and SPP, its explication of the semi-colonial and semi-feudal conditions, the need of a new type of national democratic revolution led by the proletariat, the friends of the revolution such as the toiling masses and the middle social strata, the enemies such as the exploiting classes of big compradors and landlords, the basic task of struggling for national liberation and democracy, and the socialist perspective. The CPP has been able to strengthen itself ideologically, politically, and organizationally despite tremendous odds. It has succeeded in building its own nationwide organization among the toiling masses, the People's Army, the democratic organs of political power, the mass organizations, and various types of alliances. It has prevailed over a 14-year fascist dictatorship that aimed to destroy it, as well as over succeeding regimes. It has prevailed over the ideological, political, and military attacks unleashed by these puppet regimes under U.S. direction. Some time ago, the imperialists, their puppets, and other camp followers have claimed that the history of humankind has reached its end in capitalism and liberal democracy and cannot go any further towards socialism. They have obscured the work of the modern revisionist in undermining and destroying socialism for decades and exaggerated the role of Reagan and the Pope in this regard. I mean the Pope that who had just died, no? Actually, he's overrated. There is a claim that because he was Polish and he actively supported solidarity, then the destruction came from within. No? It came from greed. No? When they forget about their revolutionary commitment, these revolutionaries, then the you don't have to. The U.S. does not have to. Or Reagan, no? Who also claims to have defeated the evil empire, he did not have to deploy hundreds of thousands of troops and use the high-tech military power of the U.S. It came from 30 years of degeneration through modern revisionism.
It's all been so described that
yeah.
It's just a rotten tree that you just checked.
Yes. And you know the Pope who just died is also credited with making friends with Castro and saving Castro from what the behemoth 90 miles away could do, no? But of course popes have wide time scale, have long views, no? They may appear to help you like Castro, but God is still the highest consideration. And the church has a good history in working its way between contending forces. The so-called barbarians had in Europe, they had Christian chaplains. Well, Imperial Rome also had its own had also the church on its side officially. So, as in the Philippines, no? you have on the side of the Philippine Revolution. You have Father Navarro. And then you have the other type in the system. Anyway, I will not steal from his steel. I will not poach. the success of neocolonialism is also obscured, no? Neocolonial, let's accept it. Neocolonialism, whether it was coming from the U.S. or even from Soviet social imperialism, succeeded in undermining and negating national independence of the backward countries. It has rendered futile the struggle for national independence. It has appeared, no? To the defenders of the imperialist system claim that they have found a way through neocolonialism to beat down the national liberation movements and the independent countries, and they have gone so far as to use what they call free market globalization. It's a monopoly capitalism, but it pretends to be neoliberal and free market, no? And then, of course, nowadays you have this so-called neoconservative drive for wars of aggression in a bid to impose Pax Americana on the people of the world in the entire 21st century. Let me say with scientific certitude and revolutionary optimism that so long as the people are oppressed and exploited, they will resist and fight for a new and better world. They will fight for national liberation, democracy, and socialism. Indeed, as oppression and exploitation are now worsening, the people's resistance is steadily spreading and intensifying throughout the world. Now let me go to the part where we try to shed light on the relations of the three ideologies in the best possible way. In this concluding part of my presentation, let me discuss how Marxism, Christianity, and liberalism can be related to each other in certain terms. To facilitate my discussion, let me proceed from the viewpoint of Marxism. I've always tried to do that, no? All throughout. Anyway. Marxists recognize that Christianity, liberalism, and Marxism have appeared on the high road of civilization in that historical sequence in the world and in the Philippines. Each of these is supposed to offer something radically new and progressive relative to something old and reactionary in a certain period of history. Christianity asserts the dignity of the human person, of freedom of conscience and love of and service to others. You know, this idea of individual freedom under bourgeois liberalism is actually derived from the Christian expression of there being the dignity of the human person, because it is a created in the image of God. No, is that a accurate rendering? And it used to be. We used to learn in literature, Negro literature, as in of course in Philippine history, Christianity comes saying that all men are equal in the eyes of God, no? And you know, that's a subversive idea to colonialism in the long run, and also subversive of white supremacy in the south of the U.S. So, you know, Christianity came with something, no? And of course, it came into contrast. It was such a progressive force because it came into contrast with and repudiation of the slavery, where you know you have a person is can be treated like an animal. You can kill, if you are the owner, you can do anything to the slave, but you cannot do that if under Christian tenets. Anyway, the Christian principles that I have mentioned made Christianity radically new and progressive relative to those of the period of slavery, but Christendom and its theocratic presumptions became suffocating relative to the advance of science and the Enlightenment. The rising aspirations of the bourgeoisie and the common people, who began to demand a new society, the separation of church and state, and a comprehensive definition of rights, including the freedom of thought and belief. Somehow, the church, anyway, in the long run, it would also adjust to the, you know, eventually in Europe, you know, the concept of humanitas would prevail over the concept of divinitas, in the sense that, for instance, society can be formed and developed because of the will of the people, and the more the will of the people is followed, then you have a more democratic kind of system. Anyway, science and the bourgeoisie were supposed to be responsible for such concepts, although for a while that was only using the rugs of the poor, to advance the ideas of the bourgeoisie, but that is a further development of human thought and human behavior. In Philippine history, Christianity has had its positive and negative manifestations. Marxists acclaimed the secularization movement and the Convulsa Martyrdom. The partisanship of the Filipino secular priest of the Philippine Revolution, the Christians for National Liberation, the outstanding resistance of the priests, nuns, and church people against the Marcos fascist dictatorship, and their continuing participation in the struggle for national liberation and democracy. These are in contrast to the long colonial history of the Catholic Church and its continuing institutional service and attachment to the secular powers of the semi-colonial and semi-feudal society. Marxism appreciates the progressive role of the bourgeoisie against feudalism in world history. It honors the revolutionary bourgeois liberalism that guided the old democratic revolution. it continues to consider as a basic force of the revolution the urban petty bourgeoisie, well, which advocates a patriotic and progressive kind of liberalism. However, it upholds the leading role of the proletariat in the new democratic revolution. It condemns the pro-imperialist and reactionary kind of liberalism. It criticizes and repudiates bourgeois rule and the bourgeois concept of freedom. In bourgeois liberalism, the democratic rights and freedoms are attributed to the individual in the abstract. The difference between exploited and exploiting classes is glossed over. First, the right to private property. There is no distinction that there is a class of individuals called capitalists and another class of individuals called working class. And then the difference between the ownership of the means of production and the ownership of the means of subsistence is obscured by the generalized right to own property as means to the pursuit of happiness. The difference between oppressor countries as colonialists and imperialists and the oppressed peoples and nations is not at all taken into account in the bourgeois Bill of Rights. What Marxism requires is that, aside from guarantees for the rights of the individuals and groups, there must be guarantees for the rights of the exploited class of individuals against the class of exploiters. Further, there must be guarantees for the rights of the entire people or nation against imperialism, neocolonialism, and colonialism. Marxists fight for a new state and new constitution that guarantees freedom from oppression by a class, state, and foreign oppressors. It is already well proven in history that Christians, liberals, and Marxists can live together, dialogue, and cooperate with others for the common good of the people. They can enjoy in common the freedom of thought and belief. They can coexist without giving up their distinctive philosophies and beliefs. You know, personally, I don't believe that you can wipe out religion, even if you are the most even if you believe so much in science, because there will always be death and suffering. And you know, there is always an aspiration of man to prolong one's life, to have a new life elsewhere, no? After the travails of this of this world. So I don't know. I will go to the people with me would hear this again, because sometimes an uncle and aunt, no? They're scientific, no? One is a doctor, the other is a pharmacist, no? When my aunt had skin disease, all the doctors said they had consulted could not treat, no? So they go for something like faith healing. So you know, it ranges from, you know, shaving your skin, so, you know, wishing life in another sphere, no? In the course of the new democratic revolution, the CPP has been leading the process of building various revolutionary forces: People's Army, organs of political power, mass organizations, alliances, and so on, in which Marxists, Christians, liberals, and people of other persuasions live in harmony and cooperate each other. They can stand on the same common social ground and negotiate and agree on social, economic, political, and cultural guiding principles and policies that are beneficial to us. You know, if you go to the root of biblical origin of Christianity. You know, living with others who are not Christians. That's well implied by give unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give unto Christ what belongs to Christ. Because when you deal with state, no, the coverage is larger, no? It includes even non-Christians. So there you see what would eventually develop as the freedom of association, the freedom of thought and belief, where Christians can coexist with others. And then, of course, Christians will always be optimistic. They can convert non-Christians, no? And but there is a democratic. Yeah, even if you call the church idealistic, autocratic, and so on, there is implied in the Christian thought that there must be freedom of conscience. You don't compel anyone, no, to believe even in Christianity, because Christians themselves underwent forcing situations, no. So, and so they wouldn't like others to be compelled. Although, of course, when the church, when the Christianity became a theocratic thing, so much power in Christendom, and it became the rallying point even for very temporal phenomena like colonialism, and you know, the most violent phenomena so far in history have been done by Christian countries, World War I, World War II. And of course, what the U.S. tries to do, Mr. Bush tries to cite God, no? So I'm gone out of my text, no? Marxist Christians, liberals, and people of other persuasions can live in harmony and cooperate with each other. They can stand on the same common social ground and negotiate and agree on social, economic, political, and cultural guiding principles and policies that are beneficial to all. In recent times, they were able to unite against the Marcos fascist dictatorship, oppose its grave human rights violations, and overthrow it in 1986. Once more, they were able to unite against the corrupt Estrada regime and removed it from power in 2001. Right now, they are considering how to oust their royal regime. Ah, current propaganda. They can agree. They can agree on the most resolute and militant course of action for the good of the entire people. They can go as far as overthrow the current unjust ruling system and replace it with a patriotic and democratic government. It is possible, desirable, and necessary for Marxists, Christians, and liberals to dialogue, cooperate, and work together in the struggle for national liberation, democracy, social justice, and all-round development. Those who do not comprehend or who lag behind in comprehending this proposition can be persuaded through patient reasoning. There are other methods than information, education, and well-reasoned persuasion for raising the level of common understanding and cooperation. But of course, there are rabid anti-communists, pro-imperialists, and die-hard reactionaries. If their position is a matter of conviction or opinion, they have the right to hold on to it, and there is no other way to deal with them but through debate or dialogue. It is an entirely different matter if they wield a new state power to suppress the Marxists and other people. The problem of armed counter-revolution is different from counter-revolutionary thinking and has to be dealt with differently. But even when there is already a clash of arms, peace negotiations are possible. Thus, the National Democratic Front of the Philippines has agreed to undertake peace negotiations with the government of the Republic of the Philippines. The substantive agenda includes respect for human rights and international humanitarian law, social and economic reforms, political and constitutional reforms, and the end of hostilities and disposition of forces. If the pro-imperialist and die-hard reactionaries succeed in scuttling the peace negotiations, it only means that they want to settle the civil war through the application of the so-called purely military solution. They are carried away by the Bush line of permanent war on terror. The revolutionary forces and people have to prepare against the worst in order to be able to hope for the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Sison. I know that listening to Joma's talk is like listening to our professors in metaphysics and Trinity all combined together. So I think we deserve a short break.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
yeah,
coffee break. 5-10 minutes break. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.